Donalena Kitchen talks about food. Donalena Kitchen talks recipes. Donalena Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Donalena Kitchen. Here we are. It's Tuesday. It's noon on Tuesday. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
This is the Donalena Kitchen. And we come to you from KHOI. This is a community radio station. We're all volunteers. We have a good time doing this. Thanks for being here around our kitchen table. We get by with a little help from our friends.
Right here in Ames, Iowa. Support comes from Wheatsfield Co-op, your full-service natural foods grocery in Ames, community-owned, community-focused since 1974 and growing daily. Open daily from 7 a.m. to 9 p.m., located downtown at 413 Northwestern, just off Main Street in Ames. Everyone can shop Wheatsfield Co-op.
And we do. This is KHOI Community Radio. We just celebrated our fourth birthday here as a station. Can you imagine? I think we're over the terrible twos now. We're into the fabulous fours. We had a celebration, and there was a book sale that went on, and the book sale just sort of was too good to close down. And I hear that for those of you who just like to thumb through a bunch of old books, there's still a few books here in the studio.
And we've got a very interesting collection, actually.
There is. Come in. It's picked over because I've been through it myself. But come down, because I hear that we are waiting for a guy with a truck to show up midweek. So come and look at the books at the radio station. That's
right. And then I think they're going down to the Planned Parenthood famous used book sale.
There we go.
In Des Moines.
So come to 410 Douglas and say hi. Say hi to us at this radio station and look at those books. So how was the weekend, Donna?
Oh, wasn't it a wild weekend?
It was. Tell them what we did on Friday.
Well, Friday night, we did the Foodies and Brew, which is the main street downtown, and it was just, the weather was spectacular. Way too spectacular. Way too spectacular.
Now, Don and I, being foodie sort of people, we were right there on the dot, and thanks to the young man at the gate who carted both of us. Oh, and we got in.
Yes,
and
I was so flattered.
We were right there, and we tasted a lot of good things. However,
the wind was blowing, you know, it was coming up with one of those wonderfully dramatic storms that we get here in the summer, and the thunder and the lightning. But the wind, I kept saying, really, there's no storm coming. This is just a wind machine. It's just special effects. And then we'd get, like, the sprinkler effect. And so we hopped around to all the food booths very quickly and all the brew very quickly.
I didn't get enough brew, but I did the best I could. I did taste something of everything.
We did. We did taste everything. And I did hear the sound check for the band. It sounded like it was going to be good. But, you know, after we had quickly munched down bites of everything, the whole thing just erupted and the rain drenched and everybody ran away.
It was one of those Iowa scrambles. So, too bad. Good try for Foodies and Brew.
They had an amazing amount of businesses participating. Lots of food. Lots of good beer. Of course, our ongoing favorite, Alluvial. And then Main Street has some new brews. Very, very interesting. Were they sour beers? I've forgotten what they were.
A summer citron thingy.
Right.
That was good.
It was very good. And then Torrent, of course, was there. So we are not without our good brews here in town. And then some great food. Of course, Battle Cry was there. That wonderful caterer, Kevin and those guys or something like that.
Yes.
Some little cakes from Pettifor. Oh, and Nitro Coffee from Bergie's. And a few million other restaurants. We eat well in this town.
We did our best. We ate fast. And then we left because I didn't get too wet.
Oh, I was drenched. And just getting to my car. It was
We'll try again.
Spectacular.
Try again next year. Three cheers to Andrew Grinnell and all those nice people that put it together.
Really,
we'll try
a lot
again
of effort went into that.
Yes.
This is a good try.
Meanwhile, today on the show, we're going to talk about the Bakken Pipeline, a little update, and we'll talk a little bit about some thoughts on back to school ideas. And meanwhile, also for this weekend, Donna, thanks for the panna cotta. This woman makes really nice panna cotta, which is just a lovely, lovely thing. And it had some black currant sauce stuff to put over the top of it. But the panna cotta itself, and Donna is a wizard with this
well,
sort of thing.
You know
Tell
why?
Me
because
the flavoring.
Panna cotta is really easy.
Well, but you know it's good. But the flavoring in to go with the black currant sauce on the top. There was something that made that panna cotta really good.
Well, I think we do have a panna cotta recipe in the archives, mm-hmm. but you can change the flavoring to suit your mood. You know, panna cotta is an Italian classic. Think of it as vanilla cream-based jello. It is a gelatin base. You try to not make it too rubbery. It should be kind of soft, but it is moldable if you want to do that. I usually put it just in a custard cup or, you know, something like that because unmolding can be, it's not easy, especially in the warm weather. You know, by the time you warm the mold up, although I have a great collection of, you know, the kind of 50s and 60s old jello molds. They are fun when one has the patience. So this panna cotta was, instead of flavoring with vanilla, which is the traditional, which is always good. I used black currant leaf, not red currants, only black currants. I have a bush in the front yard. And so you take your milk and cream and you steep the leaves in it. You know, you bring it to just under a boil, let the leaves sit in it. I actually let them sit. I cool it down a little, and then I let it sit overnight in the fridge, and then strain it off and squeeze those leaves out really good to get every bit of flavor out of them. It's subtle, but it's mm-hmm. very nice. And then I topped it with, of course, black currants. But with the black currants, of course, I put a little bit of black pepper because I like that with my fruits. And then I used yuzu jelly. That's Y-U-Z-U. Now, yuzu is a Japanese citrus. It's very like lemon, but it's like beyond lemon.
It's almost bitter. It just kind of hits you right between the
eyes.
Oh,
I just love it. It could be my favorite citrus if there is such a thing. So here's how you get yuzu in Ames. There is the Asian Food Mart that's way out on Grand, is it? West of the college.
Oh, out of Lincoln Way.
Yes, sorry. Yes, out Lincoln Way. And in there's a product called Citron something. It's how the Koreans have it is it's kind of like an orange marmalade, but it's made with yuzu. So it's traditional in citron tea, it's called. But it's a jar like marmalade, and how they drink it, and it's delicious this way, is you just warm up some hot water and put a spoonful of it. And, you know, mix it in and make a beverage. But, I mean, it has the citron, the yuzu peels in it, and it's very sweet. So for my black currant jelly, instead of adding sugar, I added the yuzu marmalade, basically, and just that together. It was
that
a lovely topping on the panna
cotta. It was lovely. Yuzu.
Y-U-Z-U.
Yuzu.
It's used a lot in Japanese food and citrus. I mean, sushi.
Sushi.
And sushi.
Speaking of Japan, you have a little short story about GMOs and the Japanese Minister of Agriculture.
Yes, this was on the PFI listserv was posted a lecture, an hour-long lecture by this fabulous, funny fellow named Lynn Clarkson, who's Clarkson Grains in central Illinois. Now, Lynn is, I would say he's probably the largest grain, corn and soybeans, organic and non-GMO verified dealer probably in the world. Mm-hmm. Still it's not a huge business because, of course, it's a smaller market. But Lynn has been doing this for a long time. He's a very experienced fellow. He really has a good, it was all about market overview. But he told this story of, so he's, you know, not that far from St. Louis, and he gets visited by a lot of international grain dealers because, you know, this stuff goes all over the world. And so the Japanese Minister of Agriculture shows up because he's buying organic soybeans to be shipped to Japan. And he gets invited by Monsanto, the Japanese Minister of Agriculture, gets invited for a tour of Monsanto. Now Lynn Clarkson says, of course, he never gets invited, but he goes along once in a while. So he went along with the Japanese minister, and they were having this wonderful tour, and, you know, showed him all of the bells and whistles down there and what they were doing with breeding and this and that. And, you know, I imagine it's a pretty flashy facility. And the Monsanto guy was saying, well, you know, they've been on the market for 13 years and da 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 da. And then he turns to the Japanese agricultural minister and he says, so what do you think of our products? And the Japanese minister, he goes, it's fabulous. It's all very, very interesting. I think what you're doing is quite remarkable. Call me in 17 years and let's see how it's doing. Because in Japan, it's like the precautionary principle. They don't want to introduce a product into their food system for the general population until it has proven healthy and safe for one full generation, which they count as 30 years. So he said, after the technology has been proven for 30 years, they will consider it for the Japanese market.
There it is.
There you have it. The wisdom of the Far East, I believe.
And we talk about it here, not enough, but we talk about it here as a precautionary principle. And as we are being precautionary about certain things, we're going to have a little bit of a update on what's going on with the Bakken pipeline that's going right through our backyard.
Oh, yes. Well, we have with us here in the studio Taylor Brorby, who is the editor of a book called Fracture. He's from North Dakota, and he knows quite a bit about the oil business. And Taylor just made a trip with Carolyn Raffensperger, who was the initiator of the precautionary principle. And Taylor just went up to where?
Up to south central North Dakota near the Standing Rock Native American Reservation, which is about an hour south of the Bismarck-Mandan area. And what's happening there just north of a town called Cannonball, which is on the reservation, there is the largest gathering of many and various Native American tribes. And a few white people. There are probably about 25 to 30 different tribal groups assembled, with more arriving each day. There are two what are known as spirit camps located along the Cannonball River, but they're estimating right now there are well over 2,000 people physically in these camps.
And what are they doing there? They're not just having a great time.
No, though they might be having a good time together, they've really unified around protesting the Dakota Access Pipeline, what we're also calling the Bakken Pipeline.
So the pipeline that's going to cut diagonally across Iowa and go right through our backyard is also crossing
North Dakota, South Dakota, and into Illinois.
Crossing the Mississippi, the Missouri,
the Des Moines River. It's crossing 8 major watersheds just here in Iowa. The pipeline originates in western North Dakota in a town called Stanley and swoops under the under Lake Sakakawea and comes down under.
So the pipeline goes under the lake. I can't even imagine how they do that, but.
Yeah, it involves some high-tech horizontal drilling to go under far enough, you know, several hundred feet under the lake. The lake is 200 feet deep in the middle. To then swoop down past the reservation and go under the Missouri River before continuing into South Dakota and entering Iowa near Sioux City and going all the way to the southeast corner of the state.
And so what are our Native brothers and sisters protesting about? How are they explaining their passionate resistance to this?
Well, the pipeline originally was planned to cross under the Missouri River north of Bismarck, North Dakota, the state capital, a town of about 70,000 people. But the company and the state government had decided it would be better to cross south of Bismarck, very close.
So that Bismarck is not downstream in case there's a leak.
Right. But there are already four pipelines that run under the Missouri River in North Dakota as well. But this would be the largest one, and it crosses just north of tribal lands, north of the Standing Rock Native American Reservation. The pipeline, for people who are new to the discussion, is 30 feet in diameter and has a carrying capacity when it's fully activated.
3 feet in diameter.
Yeah, roughly about that.
3 feet. It's huge. I mean, I'm trying to imagine. Okay, so it's like almost a yard across, and the volume that must be able to go through a pipe that big
is about 24 million gallons a day.
Can't even imagine that, and the amount of pressure to push it.
Right.
So what happens if there's a teeny-weeny little crack?
Well, there won't be a teeny-weeny little crack because the amount of force that it takes to push that amount of oil every 24 hours will sever the pipeline rather quickly to increase the break and the amount of oil that's discharged either in the water or on farmland or both. So there isn't really an idea that there will be a slow leak to this type of pipeline.
Okay, so looking at the precautionary principle, the builders of the pipeline, of course, assume no breakage, no leak, but what would precautionary principle tell us?
The precautionary principle, for people who aren't familiar with it, takes its cue from the indigenous culture's idea of that you should think seven generations into the future. So the precautionary principle begs the question of, will this, whatever we're considering, a coal mine, a pipeline, things like this, will it harm any future generations, as many as seven generations into the future? Well, now we know better. We know that coal mines are very bad for us. We know that pipelines eventually, over seven generations, will leak or break at some point. So the precautionary principle would force us to not invest in these types of technologies that are really outdated and prone to increasing destruction of our natural environments.
So the native populations are basically doing this in the interest of protecting their water sources.
That's correct. The Native American tribes in the area, when I was up there this past weekend in North Dakota at these spirit camps, you would see many billboards, one that would read "Water is life," one reading "The Dakota Access Pipeline equals genocide," one reading "The Dakota Access Pipeline plus water equals death." For Native Americans and for the rest of us, whether we admit it or not, water is the most vital resource.
Yes, we're beginning to discuss our water issues here in Ames, and this is with agricultural problems. Now, if you add on top of that oil industry problems.
Right, and this pipeline, too, for listeners in the area, will cut through Story County, and it will get as close to Ames as research
farms.
We
will have a pumping station in Ames, as a matter of fact.
And the midway point of the pipeline is near Boone. But the pipeline itself will cross research farms on Iowa State University land as well in this area.
I understand that pumping stations sound sort of like jet airplanes.
They're rather large and loud. They take a lot of force to keep pushing oil through them. Another complexity of this pipeline is Iowa exists on a tiling system. And so that means we push water into natural waterways. And one of the things we have not been discussing about this pipeline is the corrosion that will happen because of not only the toxicity of the oil in the pipeline, but also the erosion that will happen because water will hit this pipeline at all times because we're tiling it away from the prairie pothole farmland, which we use in Iowa.
Yeah, like that big rainstorm we had the other night. We get a lot of those.
Right. And as good landowners and farmers know, water always finds a way to break
through. Water moves.
And so part of it, too, is when a leak occurs, it not only means the leak can stay centralized, it means the water will carry it far and wide
quickly
into other regions. And part of this, too, this protesting is to raise awareness about what happens when oil spills occur.
Well, would I say, folks, if we think nitrates are a problem in the water, what's going to happen when we get petroleum on top of that?
It means people will not be able to drink their water, and this has happened before.
You can't really filter that out very easily.
No. There was a pipeline break about a year ago in January under the Yellowstone River in winter near Glendive, Montana, which has about 6,000 residents. And when that pipeline broke, Bakken Oil has known cancer-causing agents, which is the oil that will be flowing through this pipeline, and the town of 6,000 people could not drink their water for at least a week. They had to shower and bathe and use bottled water, but that also then puts your water supply at risk when...
Right, a week might not be long enough.
Exactly. I mean, fish as much as a month later were caught as far down as 100 miles downstream with these cancer-causing agents in their muscle tissue. So just because...
This is not a pretty story, Taylor.
It's not an uplifting one, but it's one of the topics that... It seems the narrative has been hijacked about safety around these types of issues. And a pipeline just ruptured this weekend in Saskatchewan, contaminating a town's drinking water because it spilled into the river. You know, there were just oil tankers that exploded down in the desert southwest. So some people will say it's an argument of pipelines being safer than oil tankers. But the conversation we really need to be having is why we're so set on being dependent on oil.
Yeah, that's not an either or, a pipeline or a tanker. I mean, it's posed that way, but
right. And
what
about
solar energy?
Most people will tell you that pipelines are safer because they don't tend to go through neighborhoods like oil tankers do. But oil tankers do not derail typically, or haven't, in areas that are highly populated, though in 2013, 47 people were killed in Canada from a derailed oil tanker, oil train. But the studies reveal to us and show that when pipelines explode or leak or rupture, the damage is far more significant than when oil trains derail, partly because we don't shut down the flow of oil quickly enough in these pipelines, and waterways carry it far quicker. And in the Missouri River, people are dependent farther south of the Standing Rock Native American Reservation. About 10 million people depend on just the Missouri River before it enters the Mississippi River for its drinking water. And this, of course, is water we use to irrigate our fields and to go swimming in and catch fish from and all these things. So a pipeline such as this has the potential to really...
Well, really, here in Ames, we're right in the middle of it. You know, the Bakken pipeline is trying to run right through us. And, of course, we have right in the middle of downtown... I'm sure oil tankers must go through all the time on the railroad tracks. This is an issue for us, folks.
Yes, we're talking about things happening outside of our kitchen window, right in our backyard. We're talking about the Bakken Pipeline. You're listening to KHOI 89.1. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen, Tasty Radio for the heart of Iowa. There's been some actions way upstream from us. It's going to get here soon. But we hope not get here soon, but plans are to get here soon. Up at the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation in North Dakota, there's been some political action happening up there. And Taylor Broby is in our studio talking about the situation up there. I've heard that the pipeline has been referred to as the Black Snake. That's a pretty good image. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, sure. So the imagery of the Black Snake comes from our American Indian brothers and sisters. They first referred to the Keystone XL pipeline, which would transport tar sands oil from Alberta down through areas such as Nebraska and South Dakota and Montana, down into Texas, which we know tar sands oil is some of the crudest and dirtiest oil on the planet. But now the Lakota, the Nakota, Dakota, and Lakota tribes in North Dakota are referring to the Dakota Access Pipeline as the Black Snake, which is a wonderful natural imagery because they intend to cut off the snake's head in shutting down this pipeline, which for now construction on that portion of the pipeline, which the news media is sort of getting it wrong. They're stating that construction of the pipeline has stopped, which is not true. It's still happening in other parts of North Dakota, South Dakota, Iowa, and Illinois.
Construction is happening in certain places, yeah.
But it has stopped in this very small section north of the Native American Reservation until at least tomorrow.
There's a court
There's a federal court hearing tomorrow in Washington, D.C., which listeners will want to pay attention to the media because a federal judge will determine whether or not to rule in the tribe's favor. The Standing Rock Sioux has filed an injunction to say that they are in harm's way from this pipeline and that it is doing harm to their land and their drinking water and things such as this. And whether or not the judge rules in their favor is yet to be seen. If the judge rules in the tribe's favor, construction will stop for the time being, but the Dakota Access Energy Transfer Partners, the parent company, will be able to appeal that decision to try to seek a different ruling. But if the judge does not rule in the tribe's favor, construction can resume on the pipeline immediately. So we'll find out tomorrow. Now, we don't quite know what the actions will be of our Native American brothers and sisters and the few white people we have at these spirit camps. I mean, there are over 2,000 people gathered there. And yet,
camping out along. What does it look like up there, Taylor?
Well, there are teepees and there are lodges that have been built. There are sweat lodges. There are lots of tents. But just yesterday, the director of Homeland Security had removed the hand sanitation station, had removed ambulances that were funded by the state and federal agencies, had removed the access to water that the state had provided for what they're calling the protesters, which the American Indians are relabeling themselves as protectors, which, of course, they are. They're trying to protect water and the access to clean water. Just yesterday, there were drills held by the young men who are present in the camp to find the shallowest part of the Campbell River so they may transport children safely in case tensions become very heated. And they took all young children to practice a very quick exit drill because tensions have increased because of the state government of North Dakota, as well as the Morton County Sheriff's Office.
Now, the Indians have been very adamant that they are peaceful, that this is not an armed uprising of any sort.
Right. They've been accused that they have firearms, that they have pipe bombs and M-80s and fireworks. However, this past weekend when I was up there on the ground and staying at the camps, the only things I saw were pocket knives and hatchets to cut firewood and build sweat lodges. Increasing the tension has come from state agencies and the sheriff's office in the county adjacent to the reservation. They have set up a barricade on the main thruway, Highway 1806, running south from Bismarck Mandan. You cannot get south on 1806 to access the spirit camps unless you are a local resident with a proof of address with you. Otherwise, you have to go around about 20 miles out of your way. This is simply an attempt to economically starve the tribe because there is a casino on the reservation that regularly holds concerts. It cuts off access to state parks and boat landings, and it's heightening tension between the Native American tribe and, frankly, white people. This has been a well-choreographed ploy by the state government and sheriff to justify what we might very well see tomorrow or later this week of bringing in the National Guard should force need to be necessary.
So this is kind of like a ramping up of, say, the tensions that we saw in Ferguson, for example.
And many people have already been arrested?
There have been about 28 people that have been arrested. Construction and the workers have been pulled as of last week until this ruling this week. But the arrests largely happened last week when people would cross the barricade in a very peaceful way or sit down in front of the road to not allow construction work to proceed. So it was a very sort of creative type of protesting and very gentle type of protesting as well.
Well, Taylor, for us here in Iowa, if we're not going to drive up and join the Native Americans, we have our own Bakken Pipeline organization. Right. How do people find out what's going on? How do we contribute to Iowa's understanding of this? Because it's in our backyard.
Right. There are some websites I would really recommend. The American Indigenous or the Indigenous Environmental Network, excuse me, the Indigenous Environmental Network can really get you on the ground coverage in North Dakota, so you can see how
that's
many
great long-standing organization.
Many
does
people
great work
who are, you know, speaking out on this issue.
Say the name, the
Indigenous Environmental Network.
Right, there you go.
And then for those in Iowa, you can simply look up the Bakken Pipeline Resistance Coalition. And that will give us information more on it, how it pertains to Iowa. But one thing I would encourage local listeners to really think about that's been inspiring in North Dakota, all these tribes are not directly impacted by this pipeline, but they are sending representatives from around the continent. There are over 85 tribes that have pledged resistance towards this pipeline. And one of the things I'm perceiving in Iowa is that we get very sad when an individual farmer gets impacted by this issue, when, you know, they don't sign a voluntary easement. So instead of getting $15,000 an acre for their farm, they get $3,000 to force farmers to sign over their easements.
Through eminent domain,
through eminent
which has been
domain.
Going on a lot here in Iowa.
But what I would encourage farmers and all of us to think about, and what we can learn from our, you know, our Native American brothers and sisters, is it's not individuals, though it is, but we're all in this together, and that when one farmer is impacted, we all are. And so we all need to gather together around this rather than to say we're sorry for Bob Johnson having eminent domain happen to him. It could be your farm next. I mean, that is the reality we face.
The water.
It could be the water flowing down to your farm.
Even if we are not landowners.
Right.
We're all drinkers of water.
I mean, as far as I know, Des Moines does not have an action plan when it leaks under the Des Moines River and 1.5 million people are impacted immediately and can't drink their water. What will we do?
We'll call in the National Guard.
Right.
They'll bring us bottles of water.
Or we'll try to get out somehow, I guess.
Or they'll call in the National Guard for something else.
Right.
If we are a little bit too upset, this is a good time to think about the precautionary principle.
Yes, let's all be cautious.
And ask questions, question authority. You figure there must be something there, because when we protest, there seems to be this pushback, and a pushback not just from corporations, but a pushback from government agencies,
and
too.
Sometimes it's a little heavy-handed.
Yes, it is. Well, thank you, Taylor, for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Good. So that was a little update on what's going on up at the Standing Rock Reservation in North Dakota.
You know, one thing we didn't say, and this was Carolyn Raffensperger has taught me this. She said when all of this started, the Keystone Pipeline did not happen. This is an end run around that. They let go of that because they went, oh, well, we'll just go this other route right through Iowa.
I often wonder if they did that because Iowa has a reputation for being nice. We won't, you know, all right, come right on in. That's nice.
Yeah, we're not having a spirit camp here.
Well, we may. this is important, folks. This is important. We'll have a little thought about summer gardens here.
Yes, back to something a little more cheerful.
Yeah, well, we have to talk about what's going on outside that kitchen window.
That's right. And water is, a kitchen without water is very difficult.
Yes, and so is that garden. It was a dry summer early, but we've got rains now and things are growing. Beans. I've been picking beans. I've got some nice pole beans going. And my other beans are kind of saying goodbye, but I'm kind of sick of picking beans anyway. But beans deserve a thought and deserve a little consideration here. I picked up a little book called Garden Spells, an enchanting collection of Victorian wisdom. This may be not the scientific look at beans, but this may be something we should think about. It talks about magical gardens and garden spells.
And Lana has a very magical garden, so she knows whereof she speaks.
Yeah, I tend to go at my plants spiritually, but, you know, that works, too.
Aesthetically,
Aesthetically,
sure. It's just beautiful out there.
Here's a few thoughts on beans. If you would create a garden with magic at its heart, where fairies would come to make sport at eventide, and which grows for your health and your happiness, then cherish a number of ancient herbs and flowers. Cherish months, the stars, the planets, and the angels. Beans, grow a crop of beans, for these celebrate the powers of the goddess. The soul of this plant knows the secrets of the rites of life, death, and rebirth. There's wisdom in the scent of the bloom of the bean, which only the spirit can hear. The myth of the plant is that it sings to wandering ghosts and guides them on their way to supernatural realms. You, take a stroll in your garden and inhale the perfume of beans, for then you may be sure to dream a prophetic dream. But be wary, for you will touch the essence of your very soul with your nighttime visions, and the truth in these visions is sometimes a burden, sometimes a nightmare. Ride that truth. It can be a fearsome journey.
Beans, 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 beans. Those Victorians, they knew. So we've been inhaling the night blossoms, we've been having visions, and we've been going to spirit camps.
Yes, we have.
It's a busy time of year here.
That sort of thing is quite important. You're listening to KHOI 89.1 Story City Ames. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. The Donna Lana Kitchen, and we have a little item here from the Donna Lana Kitchen News Department. Tick-a-dick, tick-a-dick, tick-a-dick. That is the Donna Lana Kitchen ticker tape.
And this is good news.
This is
good
news.
As opposed to the bummer news. We finished with the bummer news for today.
It's important to keep track of what's happening with that pipeline. But in the current news, and where do we get our news? But from the Ames Tribune. How nice. Ames Tribune, Sunday paper. Headline. Alluvial Brewing Company ranked fourth best college town Brewery.
Woohoo!
Now, who in the world goes around and does all these this taste testing and
what
ranking?
A nice bit of research, huh?
I don't know. But despite being open for only a little more than a year and a half, Alluvial Brewing Company, north of Ames, has been named the fourth best college town brewery in the country by...
That's high ranking for us.
Yeah. They've been named that by the college housing website UCribs. That's U, lowercase U, Cribs, capital C, UCribs. So I don't know who they are, but thank you for your interest in a local brewery. And this is a big deal, I guess. Like Donna said, it's a big place. Breweries are all over.
Yeah, and can you imagine how many college towns there are in this country?
Oh, for goodness sake.
Each with their own local brew?
Right. Iowa actually had two breweries on the list. Alluvial, here in Ames.
North of Ames.
And Single Speed Brewing Company in Cedar Falls, which was ranked number 12. Get that. And given the fact that Colorado and California combined for the 6 of the top 10 listings, that's a pretty big deal. It's an example of how far Iowa has come.
Ho, ho. See what we have going on out on the prairie here.
Yeah. Now,
proud.
Alluvial Brewing Company is not really on campus or close to campus. You have to kind of want to get there. It's very bikeable, and people do. It's north of town a bit, and they have good beer. So congratulations to all those good folks out there that make
They also
drink.
Have a wonderful prairie and a patio out on the prairie with the coolest chairs you can never believe. It's really a fun place to go.
I watched the rise of the last full moon out there. Hint, hint, that's a good thing to do for all you moon watchers out there.
It's beautiful and it's got good brew.
So, thinking of college town breweries, that brings us to thoughts of fall and back to school. Hey, Ames, guess what?
I think it was today the first day of college classes,
I don't know.
Maybe?
All I know is they're back.
Oh, boy.
So for many young people, this is an exciting time. But you soon come up against this, how does one feed oneself?
Yeah, there's some harsh realities to college life, you know, if it's the first time you're away from home and you have to do all the things that your parents used to do for you, like cooking and laundry. So we have with us Eric Lynn, who is going to tell us how he solved that problem. So here's a little advice for all you new students. Eric, tell us how you feed yourself.
Well, first, thank you for having me on. This is exciting. Interestingly, I saw a theme happening in the first part of the show. We were talking about a precautionary principle. And if you're someone who doesn't want to just think one meal ahead, but maybe seven meals
planning, yes, look ahead.
This is an option for you college students.
So it gets you out of the throw the ramen in the pot and malnourish yourself?
Yeah. This is a way to be healthy and to be efficient. And it comes with a little bit of a story. Last year, I was out in Providence, Rhode Island, getting a teaching license. And actually, not last year, 2 years ago now. And I was living with five wonderful people. And one of them was a PhD student in the Brown Physics Department. His name was Joe. And Joe is a home brewer, and he is a great cook in his own right. But one thing that he specializes in is efficiency.
He studied this apparently.
Well, he's into fluid dynamics at Brown University, and to get you an idea of how his mind works, we were at a very crowded 4th of July event, and as the crowds were all leaving, we all had to go up this one staircase, and it was probably 2,000, 3,000 people trying to go up just this one flight of stairs. And he was able to use fluid dynamics to get up there more quickly than everyone else. He sort of followed the outside route or whatever it was to get up there. So this is how he thinks. He's a very, very efficient person, and he didn't want to spend any more time in the kitchen than he had to. He has lots of things to do, lots of research, and a lot
of college. But he wanted optimum nutrition.
He wanted optimum nutrition.
And fuel.
And he – one thing about college that a lot of college students know, too, is that – you know, it's not so easy when you don't have a car to just quick go get a bike to eat or quick go home and cook something up. You have to often bring lunch with you, and bringing a cold sandwich every day, a bologna sandwich or some Lunchables probably isn't always the most fun. So what Joe would do is he would put on some music, and for about 5 hours on Sunday, he'd take out his big cast iron skillet, and after about a 45-minute trip to the grocery store, he'd bring back a whole bunch of fresh vegetables, usually peppers, fresh carrots, fresh onions, beans. I'm trying to think of
garlic.
Any sort of good fresh food that he could find, and vegetables. And he would just start the cast iron skillet, and he would go to town for about 5 hours frying all these things and these good foods. One after another, he'd kind of go in these shifts. He'd first do the carrots, and then he'd do the peppers, and then he'd do the onions. And by the end of 5 hours, he would put together about enough meals for 2 meals a day for about 10 days. So he would.
10 days. That's probably optimum shelf life in the refrigerator. Yeah. I would say. No, you can do it.
Mm-hmm.
If it's fresh when you start. Because
exactly.
If you're buying prepared foods from the grocery store and you bring them home and let them sit 5 days on the shelf, you don't know how long they've already been sitting mm-hmm. in the refrigerator state, you know, at the prepared foods place. So
in warehouses.
Yeah. Or who knows where. So, but if you're cooking something from scratch and you cook it and refrigerate it properly, 10 days should do
and
it.
Part of me thinks it's also, you know, he would use a hefty amount of olive oil when he was doing it. And then those juices all kind of sit together. And I don't know, does setting something in olive oil sort of preserve it a little bit longer?
No,
than it
but
would?
It makes
no?
it taste okay. really good. It's a temperature. Yeah. It's a time and temperature thing. You mm-hmm. have to keep it refrigerated.
Yeah. So, but he – and how he would differentiate – so one thing that's probably you'd notice about this, if you just had fresh vegetables every day, I mean, it tastes good by itself, but he'd also cook it with some rice. He always had a big pot of rice in the fridge as well. But, you know, that would get boring. You know, after about the third day, you're looking at, you know, the same bowl of rice and the same cooked vegetables, and you go, this isn't
– rice and vegetables. Yes.
Yeah, every day.
That's an old hippie classic, Eric. I want you to know that your generation did not just invent that.
Yeah. Well, so what he would do is our fridge door was just full of all these sauces that he would
condiments.
Get. Yeah, he would go to a bunch of different stores, and he probably knew more about – the sauces in the food aisle than anyone else I know. He had tried all the different pestos at the grocery store, and he had found his, you know, perfect one. And he told me.
So it wasn't all just hot sauce.
No. You could use salsa, hot sauce. He would use marinara.
Some great Asian ones too.
Yeah, mm-hmm, a lot of
sweet and sour.
A chipotle raspberry sauce he had on one of them, and you could also. At the end of it, you know, if you wanted to have just a little bit, especially when you're getting to the 10th day and these vegetables are looking a little questionable, what you can do is you can take a fresh tomato and slice it over it or kind of.
You know, at any time you also could put salad dressing on them too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So
there's tricks.
There are tons of tricks. And you know, our refrigerator at one point. So he was the person who started this. He would call this yum bowl, as in a yummy bowl of food. But when he told me about it, he would say, oh, yeah, I'm just making my yum bowl. And I always thought it was spelled yum bowl rhymes with humble. And so at one point in our house of about six people, four of us were doing our yum bowl routines every.
See, so when Eric started telling me about his yum bowl, I thought, this is a really good idea. We've got to talk about Yumble on the radio. Yeah. We want to encourage you guys to eat your brown rice and vegetables, mm-hmm. or you could do another starch in it too, I suppose.
Oh, I'm sure if you wanted to do some sort of noodle. Often what I would do is in the morning, if I didn't want to have rice, I would have some toast and fry
just
an egg and then put the fresh vegetables over the egg.
Yeah, or rice and beans or
mm-hmm.
other grains, barley, quinoa. You can switch it up with the starch. Any whole grains makes whole grains and vegetables, and then you can, of course, you could add cheese or, as you said, eggs.
Mm-hmm.
Switch up your proteins with it. This is a good daily strategy that your mothers would all approve of and be very delighted that you're feeding yourselves well.
When I was going through my student teaching semester there, and that can be always a very stressful time when you don't have time to cook. And often you're at the school, and you either have the option of those famous school lunches, which are always so nutritious and delicious, or you could bring something you've made yourself. And so it was such an easy thing in the morning to just take my scoop of rice, my scoop of vegetables, put it in a nice little, you know, container and microwave it when I got there. So pretty easy.
And if these new folks coming to town to be students, if you've never cooked before, this sounds like a good opportunity. Get to know your vegetables. Cook them up a little bit.
Just get really good at chopping them, because that's
the – chopping is good.
It will take about, you know, a couple hours to get them all chopped when you're doing 15 carrots.
Hours sounds a long time. I mean, I'm sorry, but I bet I could whip it all out in about 2 hours maximum.
Well, we're using college knives, so it's mostly butter knives.
Okay. The trick is,
so get some good knives.
Gonna make your own yumble, do invest in one good knife. I always say one good chopping knife. Now, it's, you know, a good chopping knife can cost you $80 or $90, but let me tell you, it will last you your whole life.
And a sharpener, too.
Yeah.
Or maybe someone would give you that as kind of a Christmas gift. That's a good idea. That sounds like yumble. Yumble sounds like a good start, good way to feed yourself. You also were talking about a cucumber recipe, Eric.
Oh, yeah. So,
Eric's mother's cucumber recipe.
Yeah. So my mom and my dad have a couple gardens around our house back in Rochester, Minnesota. And one thing that we always seem to have an issue with is we love tomatoes, and we can probably eat all the tomatoes we ever make. But cucumbers, I guess, when you plant them, you kind of need to plant them. I don't know.
You get a lot of cucumbers all at once,
and you get
right?
all the cucumbers all at once, and you just go, well, geez, what am I going to do with all these? And so my mom, using her mom's recipe for some refrigerator pickles that I sent over to Lana.
They're really good, and we're really in cucumber season right now. So here is Eric's mother's refrigerator pickles. A cup of vinegar. She uses apple cider because that's what Grandma May used, she said. Teaspoon of salt, 2 cups of sugar. She uses less sugar. I would agree with her. I think 1 cup of sugar is fine. She uses a cup of sliced. Now, Eric's mom, the jar that she sent down was so nicely sliced, I must say.
Sharp knife.
Yes. She uses Vidalia onion, or you could use it. There's good onions right now. 1 cup of sliced green pepper, and she had mixed colored peppers because it was really pretty. A teaspoon of celery seed, half teaspoon of mustard seed, half teaspoon of turmeric. So the process is basically you put the cut vegetables into the jar, raw. This is a raw pickled, it's not a canned dish. It's something you just keep in the refrigerator. You heat the vinegar and the sugar and the spices, and then you pour the hot vinegar over the raw vegetables. Let them sit. I don't know. How long should you leave them in the fridge before you eat them? A few weeks?
She would only just do it a couple days. Oh. You know, it kind of keeps that fresh cucumber
taste. Yeah, they were nice and crunchy and really delicious.
And I think what she says, too, is that before you pour the brine over the cucumber, you kind of set the cucumbers out and put salt over them a little bit, so then they'll soak up.
Oh, so they juice out a little.
Mm-hmm, yeah. So that helps with the.
Well, it's a really good recipe, and it's the right time of year to do it. And thank you, Eric's mom, Marlene.
Marlene, thank you.
Very good. We could put that one on the website. Find out more about Donalana Kitchen and find our recipe page, you can go to the khoyfm.org website. You can find a picture of Donna and I. You can find all past shows if you just can't get enough of us. Right. You are listening to the Donalana Kitchen. Today we've had music by Wild Asparagus, a fine contra dance band. Support this fine radio station. Listen to the Donalana Kitchen Tuesdays at noon or 7 p.m. or 7 p.m.
Any
on Tuesday.
Time.
Or stream, podcast, or all that other stuff. And when you go to the khoyfm.org website, donate to this fine radio station. This is Community Radio. My name's Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We've had excellent engineering by Evan Taylor today. Fine guests, Taylor Broby and Eric Lynn. Eat good food and enjoy life.
Thank you.